Mrs. Montressor to Mrs. De Wint, 32 Curzon Street, Mayfair, May 27th. Oh, my dearest Bessie, how I wish we were out of this dreadful, dreadful house. Please don't think me very ungrateful for saying this after your taking such pains to provide us with a heaven upon earth, as you thought. What has happened could, of course, have been neither foretold nor guarded against by any human being. About 10 days ago, Benson, my maid, came to me with a very long face and said, "If you please, ma'am, did you know that this house was haunted?" I was so startled. You know what a coward I am. I said, "Good heavens, no! Is it?" "Well, ma'am, I'm pretty nigh sure it is," she said, and the expression of her countenance was about as lively as an undertaker's. And then she told me that cook had been that morning to order groceries from a shop in the neighborhood, and on her giving the man the direction where to send the things to, he had said with a very peculiar smile, "Number 32 Curzon Street, eh? I wonder how long you'll stand it. Last lot held out just a fortnight." He looked so odd that she asked him what he meant, but he only said, "Oh, nothing, only that parties never do stay long at 32. He had known parties go in one day and out the next, and during the last 4 years he had never known any remain over the month. Feeling a good deal alarmed by this information, she naturally inquired the reason, but he declined to give it, saying that if she had not found it out for herself, she had much better leave it alone, as it would only frighten her out of her wits. And on her insisting and urging him, she could only extract from him that the house had such a villainously bad name that the owners were glad to let it for a mere song. You know how firmly I believe in apparitions, and what an unutterable fear I have of them. Anything material, tangible, that I can lay hold of, anything of the same fiber, blood, and bone as myself, I could, I think, confront bravely enough, but the mere thought of being brought face to face with the bodiless dead makes my brain unsteady. The moment Henry came in, I ran to him and told him, but he pooh-poohed the whole story, laughed at me, and asked whether we should turn out of the prettiest house in London at the very height of the season because a grocer said it had a bad name. Most good things that had ever been in the world had had a bad name in their day, and moreover, the man had probably a motive for taking away the house's character, some friend for whom he coveted the charming situation and the low rent. He derided my babyish fears, as he called them, to such an extent that I felt half ashamed, and yet not quite comfortable either. And then came the usual rush of London engagements, during which one has no time to think of anything but how to speak and act and look for the moment then present. Adela was to arrive yesterday, and in the morning our weekly hamper of flowers, fruit, and vegetables arrived from home. I always dress the flower vases myself. Servants are so tasteless. And as I was arranging them, it occurred to me, you know Adela's passion for flowers, to carry up one particular cornucopia of roses and mignonette and set it on her toilet table as a pleasant surprise for her. As I came downstairs, I had seen the housemaid, a fresh round-faced country girl, go into the room, which was being prepared for Adela, with a pair of sheets that had been airing over her arm. I went upstairs very slowly, as my cornucopia was full of water, and I was afraid of spilling some. I turned the handle of the bedroom door and entered, keeping my eyes fixed on my flowers to see how they bore the transit, and whether any of them had fallen out. Suddenly a sort of shiver passed over me, and feeling frightened, I did not know why, I looked up quickly. The girl was standing by the bed, leaning forward a little, with her hands clenched in each other, rigid, every nerve tense, her eyes wide open, starting out of her head, and a look of unutterable stony horror in them, her cheeks and mouth not pale, but livid, as those of one that died a while ago in mortal pain. As I looked at her, her lips moved a little, and an awful hoarse voice, not like hers in the least, said, "Oh, my God, I have seen it!" And then she fell down suddenly, like a log with a heavy noise. Hearing the noise, loudly audible all through the thin walls and floors of a London house, Benson came running in, and between us we managed to lift her onto the bed and tried to bring her to herself by rubbing her feet and hands and holding strong salts to her nostrils. And all the while we kept glancing over our shoulders in a vague cold terror of seeing some awful shapeless apparition. 2 long hours she lay in a state of utter unconsciousness. Meanwhile, Harry, who had been down to his club, returned. At the end of 2 hours, we succeeded in bringing her back to sensation and life, but only to make the awful discovery that she was raving mad. She became so violent that it required all the combined strength of Harry and Phillips, our butler, to hold her down in the bed. Of course, we sent off instantly for a doctor, who, on her growing a little calmer towards evening, removed her in a cab to his own house. He has just been here to tell me that she is now pretty quiet, not from any return to sanity, but from sheer exhaustion. We are, of course, utterly in the dark as to what she saw, and her ravings are far too disconnected and unintelligible to afford us the slightest clue. I feel so completely shattered and upset by this awful occurrence that you will excuse me, dear, I'm sure, if I write incoherently. One thing I need hardly tell you, and that is that no earthly consideration would induce me to allow Adela to occupy that terrible room. I shudder and run by quickly as I pass the door. Yours in great agitation, Cecilia.
Mrs. De Wint to Mrs. Montressor. The Lord Warden, Dover, May 28th. Dearest Cecilia, yours just come? How very dreadful. But I am still unconvinced as to the house being in fault. You know, I feel a sort of godmother to it and responsible for its good behavior. Don't you think that what the girl had might have been a fit? Why not? I myself have a cousin who is subject to seizures of the kind, and immediately on being attacked his whole body becomes rigid, his eyes glassy and staring, his complexion livid, exactly as in the case you describe. Or, if not a fit, are you sure that she has not been subject to fits of madness? Please, be sure and ascertain whether there is not insanity in her family. It is so common nowadays, and so much on the increase, that nothing is more likely. You know my utter disbelief in ghosts. I am convinced that most of them, if run to earth, would turn out about as genuine as the faint Cock Lane one. But, even allowing the possibility, nay, the actual unquestioned existence of ghosts in the abstract, is it likely that there should be anything to be seen so horribly fear-inspiring as to send a perfectly sane person in one instant raving mad, which you, after 3 weeks' residence in the house, have never caught a glimpse of? According to your hypothesis, your whole household ought, by this time, to be stark staring mad. Let me implore you not to give way to a panic which may possibly, probably prove utterly groundless. Oh, how I wish I were with you to make you listen to reason. Artie ought to be the best prop ever woman's old age was furnished with, to indemnify me for all he and his whooping cough have made me suffer. Oh, write immediately, please, and tell me how the poor patient progresses. Oh, had I the wings of a dove, I shall be on wires till I hear again. Yours, Bessie.
Mrs. Montressor to Mrs. De Wint, Number 5, Bolton Street, Piccadilly, June 12th. Dearest Bessie, You will see that we have left that terrible, hateful, fatal house. How I wish we had escaped from it sooner. Oh, my dear Bessie, I shall never be the same woman again if I live to be 100. Let me try to be coherent and to tell you connectedly what has happened. And first, as to the housemaid, she has been removed to a lunatic asylum, where she remains in much the same state. She has had several lucid intervals, and during them has been closely, pressingly questioned as to what it was she saw, but she has maintained an absolute, hopeless silence, and only shudders, moans, and hides her face in her hands when the subject is broached. 3 days ago I went to see her, and on my return was sitting resting in the drawing-room before going to dress for dinner, talking to Adela about my visit, when Ralph Gordon walked in. He has always been walking in the last 10 days, and Adela has always flushed up and looked very happy, poor little cat, whenever he made his appearance. He looked very handsome, dear fellow, just come in from the park, seemed in tremendous spirits, and was as skeptical as even you could be as to the ghostly origin of Sarah's seizure. "Let me come here tonight and sleep in that room, do, Mrs. Montressor," he said, looking very eager and excited. "With the gas lit and a poker, I'll engage to exorcise every demon that shows his ugly nose, even if I should find 7 white ghostesses sitting on 7 white postesses." "You don't mean really?" I asked incredulously.
"Don't I? That's all," he answered emphatically.
"I should like nothing better."
"Well, is it a bargain?"
Adela turned quite pale. "Oh, don't," she said hurriedly. "Please don't. Why should you run such a risk? How do you know that you might not be sent mad, too?" He laughed very heartily and colored a little with pleasure at seeing the interest she took in his safety.
"Never fear," he said. "It would take more than a whole squadron of departed ones with the old gentleman at their head to send me crazy."
He was so eager, so persistent, so thoroughly in earnest, that I yielded at last, though with a certain strong reluctance, to his entreaties. Adela's blue eyes filled with tears, and she walked away hastily to the conservatory and stood picking bits of heliotrope to hide them. Nevertheless, Ralph got his own way. It was so difficult to refuse him anything. We gave up all our engagements for the evening, and he did the same with his. At about 10 o'clock he arrived, accompanied by a friend and brother officer, Captain Burton, who was anxious to see the result of the experiment. "Let me go up at once," he said, looking very happy and animated. "I don't know when I have felt in such good tune. A new sensation is a luxury not to be had every day of one's life. Turn the gas up as high as it will go, provide a good stout poker, and leave the issue to Providence and me." We did as he bid. "It's all ready now," Henry said, coming downstairs after having obeyed his orders. "The room is nearly as light as day. Well, good luck to you, old fellow." "Goodbye, Miss Bruce," Ralph said, going over to Adela and taking her hand with a look half laughing, half sentimental. "Fare thee well, and if forever, then forever fare thee well. That is my last dying speech and confession. Now mind," he went on, standing by the table and addressing us all, "if I ring once, don't come. I may be flurried and lay hold of the bell without thinking. If I ring twice, come." Then he went jumping up the stairs, 3 steps at a time, and humming a tune. As for us, we sat in different attitudes of expectation and listening about the drawing-room. At first we tried to talk a little, but it would not do. Our whole soul seemed to have passed into our ears. The clock's ticking sounded as loud as a great church bell close to one's ear. Addie lay on the sofa with her dear little white face hidden in the cushions. So we sat for exactly an hour, but it seemed like 2 years, and just as the clock began to strike 11, a sharp ting-ting-ting rang clear and shrill through the house. "Let us go," said Addie, starting up and running to the door. "Let us go," I cried too, following her. But Captain Burton stood in the way and intercepted our progress. "No," he said decisively, "you must not go. Remember, Gordon told us distinctly, if he rang once, not to come. I know the sort of fellow he is, and that nothing would annoy him more than having his directions disregarded." "Oh, nonsense," Addie cried passionately. "He would never have rung if he had not seen something dreadful. Do, do let us go," she ended, clasping her hands. But she was overruled, and we all went back to our seats. 10 minutes more of suspense, next door to unendurable. I felt a lump in my throat, a gasping for breath. 10 minutes on the clock, but 1,000 centuries on our hearts. Then again, loud, sudden, violent, the bell rang. We made a simultaneous rush to the door. I don't think we were 1 second flying upstairs. Addie was first. Almost simultaneously, she and I burst into the room. There he was, standing in the middle of the floor, rigid, petrified, with that same look, that look that has burnt into my heart in letters of fire, of awful, unspeakable, stony fear on his brave young face. For one instant he stood thus, then stretching out his arms stiffly before him, he groaned in a terrible, husky voice. "Oh, my God, I have seen it," and fell down dead. Yes, dead, not in a swoon or in a fit, but dead. Vainly we tried to bring back the life to that strong young heart. It will never come back again till the day when the earth and the sea give up the dead that are therein. I cannot see the page for the tears that are blinding me. He was such a dear fellow. I can't write any more today. Your broken-hearted Cecilia. This is a true story.